We are recording on the lands of the Wurundjeri Woi Wurrung people, and we acknowledge them as traditional owners. We'd also like to pay our respects to their elders, past, present, and emerging. Always was, always will be, Aboriginal land.
Midnight to midnight. Welcome. Screening. Welcome to midnight screening. Welcome to screening. Welcome to midnight screening. I am screaming. I am screaming.
I am screaming.
Welcome to Midnight Screening, where we let you stay up past your bedtime with the movies you probably shouldn't be watching. I'm Noah Jansen. Hello, Eliza. How are we?
I'm good. Whatever happened to Noah J?
Whatever happened to Noah J and our friend Anthony Carr?
C.
How are you, Anthony?
Not too bad.
We introduced last week, there is a very specific intonation.
Yeah, I didn't come up with that. I don't know.
We should have claimed it was us because... I think it would be scary to people if they didn't know what we were talking about and we started doing it. Maybe we want them to feel left out. I don't know. There's a trailer for Whatever Happened to Baby Jane that is the kind of thing where like the exact intonation with which they say it locks onto your brain.
Yeah.
We have a lot of movies like that where like the specific way a thing was said is more memorable than the quote, like than the actual line itself. I've talked before about In the Incredibles.
Yeah.
old school like the old school.
That's old school. The reason we're like this, the reason we're acting like fools is because you have reached us in the middle of our midnight marathon of hagsploitation cinema.
Our brains are decaying. Age and time are coming for our minds. And we are left with are these ridiculous camp classics.
Yay, that's all right.
When I go to the pod, I want to watch those camp classics. This is part two of our Midnight Marathon deep dive into the hagsploitation subgenre. So we laid a lot of groundwork last week over on the pod talking about this is a genre that... You know, we're always walking the delicate line between are we laughing at these women? Are we laughing with them? How much do these stories exploit them? How much do they give women the opportunity to play more textured
parts and later in life?
Yeah, parts later in life than they usually get. And also films from an era where, you know, the only stories we really tell about women are about them as objects of affection or... people constantly, you know, seeking the prized, social, like women of their era or their time, as opposed to what it is to be a woman in the later half of life. And the thing that used to give you social currency was your looks or your fame or whatever it is. And now time is forgetting you or, you know, the public is forgetting you. So it's a real interesting collision of a lot of sort of ideas that we find very interesting.
Yes.
And today we are popped right back in the middle of a feud that last week we laid out. I think
it's on the Patreon, but you really should listen to it for Noah dropping some wisdom about the actual feud between Betty Davis and Joan Crawford.
I went deep this week. I was already reading Joan Crawford's autobiography, My Way of Life, and then was like, you know what? We're doing hagsploitation. I'm going to have to listen to Betty Davis's second autobiography, This and That. So today we are back to the Betty and Joan conflict, which I will be peppering with some fun facts.
Did you get any like actual good housekeeping tips from Joan Crawford? Are you like, oh yeah, that's how I meant to fold it?
I actively tried to fight most things I read from Joan Crawford's My Way of Life. The funniest part of like comparing these two women is like they don't have to outline why they are different from each other. They just, what their priorities are in the books that they write is so clear. It is so, so funny. So maybe before we talk about the two films, I'm going to give you a little insight into something that we pointed out last week, which was both of these very famous Hollywood dames had their one of their daughters, one of their beautiful, like beloved children, write a tell-all expose book about them. Joan Crawford's much more famously with her daughter writing Mummy Dearest, which was made into like probably one of the like Mount Rushmore camp films, Mummy Dearest. But Betty Davis's daughter also wrote one.
Who also appeared in Whatever Happened to Baby Jane.
Did indeed. And it's the classic case of like, you know, there are two sides to every story. Equally, the Mummy Dearest book is full of things that seem like exaggerations, but there's a lot of truth to them. Essentially, this is much more common of that era in general, but it's always both books are mother and daughter both saying to each other, you don't realize how hard it was for me. You are wrong and I am right. So they both view things in very like black and white terms, which are not correct. That being said, the things in Betty Davis's daughter's book, which is called My Mother's Keeper, are a lot more around just generally having a mother that is very career focused and personality wise, especially for her era, is a woman that is much more possibly like chaotic, or I don't know what the term is, essentially just
she
being
was
very
not
volatile.
Seen, yeah, as like a ladylike, well-behaved woman or whatever.
No, essentially the public reaction to this book was the reason that we love her in film roles and stuff is because what other woman at this level of fame is this openly
acts like a man.
Able to be like demanding, able to ask for what they want, able to set standards for themselves.
But equally, that doesn't make her the most affectionate mom. Maybe.
It doesn't. And like she would, you know, she would like spank them. She would be violent towards them. But the book is full of like extreme extrapolations and really like calling her out for incidents that you're like, that would be a lot of people of this era's like experience with having a mother in general. Yeah. But the end of this and that is an afterword where My Mother's Keeper ends with Betty Davis's daughter writing a letter to her. So she chooses to write a letter to her daughter at the end of her book, where she essentially says, I gave you the greatest upbringing. You are so privileged. I gave you everything you could want. And it's so disappointing that you're this like spoiled child now. Then there's an afterword. And this is the pettiest thing. Like I was cackling while listening to it. The afterword of this and that is three pieces of fan mail that Betty Davis received from women being like, I'm a mother too. The fact that any child could say this about their mother is disgusting. Like being a mother is hard enough as it is. You're always going to do something wrong. And, you know, and you were an actress, let alone like playing all those incredible roles. What did she expect? And then including three reviews slamming the book, My Mother's
Just
Keeper.
On its quality, being like, this book sucks.
Being like, it's really badly written. Oh. It's very, like, baseless. It largely feels like she doesn't see herself as a victim in any of these scenarios. Again, I'm like, I don't think she's wrong. Like, I think that she probably was, like, my mother was, like, cruel.
Really tough.
And, like, pretty cold. But was, like, much more present than Joan Crawford was, for example. Anyway, so then it has three pieces of fan mail siding with her. It has three reviews against
Trashing
My Mother's
her daughter's
Keeper.
Book.
And then the very last line of her book is, shut up, JD.
Oh my goodness.
You write a book and the very last lines of the
shut
book
up my daughter.
Shut up to your daughter.
The most high effort diss track of all time.
Exactly.
That is so vindictive and petty.
So
oh my
BD.
God.
It's BD time. And she says, shut up, BD. That's the last line of the book. Which is like you've made the case for her book as well. Anyway.
Oh my goodness. You know what's
the
hilarious?
Kind of hag-esque, hag-adjacent behavior we're talking about.
More than hag exploitation, this all, and also Joan Crawford's thing, like both of them being like, oh, you ungrateful child. That is so extremely camp and melodrama.
It is.
Of like, if all the great melodramas of the 30s and 40s are like, well, many of them are about a mother who will do anything for her children and they walk all over her and betray her. Mm. Like that's Mildred Pierce.
Absolutely.
And so for them to then reflect that in their personal lives is like Oh my goodness.
And this era of films is just, yeah, is absolutely being like what it is to be surrounded by privilege and decadence and mm. be like, you get everything, you know?
Yeah.
So yeah, it was a funny one of being like, I haven't read My Mother's Keeper. I've just read how Betty Davis reacts to it.
And you're there's like, a whole, this is a little bit of telling on yourself.
Betty it Davis. Is. It is. Yeah. And like her wow. daughter is in this like horrible, she got married to a guy who was like 30 something when she was like 16 years oh. old and he was super controlled. So there's an element of like her being distanced from her mother, but mm. also being like, I, when you babysit my kids, you spank them and like they wow. are scared to hang out with you. So, you know, it's all, my it's gosh. All very black and white when I'm like, I think the reality is maybe we're all a bit messed up and we've tried to be famous women in Hollywood in the 40s and 50s and 60s. Like, come on.
Speaking of black and white, both mm-hmm. the movies today, both came out the same year. Both are black and white.
They are. What are we talking about?
We're talking about Hush, Hush, Sweet Charlotte. Hush, in many Hush, ways, Sweet a movie Charlotte. We could have done last week with Baby Jane.
Mm-hmm. They're both, so Hush, Hush, Sweet Charlotte and Baby Jane, both directed by Robert Aldrich, both made to be Betty Davis and Joan Crawford, mm. even though Joan Crawford eventually, due to an injury in the first week of filming, had to pull out of Hush, Hush, Sweet Charlotte. But in plotting, I think we're going to talk a lot about how Hush, Hush, Sweet Charlotte feels like a thematically expanded take mm. on the ideas of Baby Jane. Really, really interesting film. And the second film we're talking about to cover our friend Joan Crawford is Straightjacket.
Yes.
Which
yes.
in terms of the like pulpy, schlocky end of hagsploitation is sort of a poster child, I would think. It feels wonderful. Like... very much like, you know, what a John Waters film would
oh, yeah.
be, you know, referencing like I Serial mean, Mom yeah, is
apparently
all over
there's
it.
A clip of it in Serial Mom.
Yeah.
Which is like,
yeah, it's all over on. It. Let's start with Hush, Hush, Sweet Charlotte.
Hush, Hush, Sweet Charlotte.
She'll tease you, she'll unease you, all the better just to please you. She's precocious and she knows just what it takes to make a pro blush. All the boys think she's a spy,
she's got Betty Davis eyes. Can I just interrupt and say, I used to think it was hump a bathtub just to please you.
I would hump a bathtub to please anyone if they needed that from me.
But Betty Davis wouldn't hump a bathtub just to please anyone.
No, she would not. Betty Davis heard this song. She hears those lyrics. And what was Betty Davis's response to that verse? How did she know? In her great. Book, she starts a chapter with those lyrics and says, I love that song.
Oh,
I was
that's
like,
so good.
How did she know me? That's how I feel about my eyes and my gaze. When it went platinum, the singer of the song sent her one of the platinum records and she has oh. it proudly hung above her desk.
I'm so glad she likes the song.
She
that
loves
song
the song.
Rocks.
And it's it really good. Captures something that we talked a little bit about with Baby Jane and is literally like exhaust, like beautiful in this film. Like we were all like tearing up at it in this film. Is the moments of stillness and truth in her eyes throughout this film with how brilliantly painted this woman is. Let's talk
Charlotte.
About Hush, Hush, Sweet Charlotte. So the plot of the film is, as with a lot of these films, a lot of horror in general, we have an opening trauma, essentially.
Mm.
It's the night of like a sort of debutante ball and there is essentially a young girl, young Sweet Charlotte, and she has been sleeping with
a married man.
A married man, played by a very young, very attractive
Bruce
looking
Dern.
Bruce Dern. Bruce Dern, essentially Sweet Charlotte's dad. Sweet
Are you going to call her Sweet Charlotte?
Charlotte's dad has found out about this. And like the movie starts with a conversation between him and Bruce Dern being like, you cannot, like, I know you are going to run away.
You'll stay away from my daughter now, you hear?
Yeah, I know you're going to run away with her.
It's in the South, by the way. It's in New Orleans.
Yeah. Like,
it's in Louisiana.
Yeah, and the whole atmosphere and location of the movie is amazing.
So Southern Gothic.
Yeah, very, very stunning to look at. So he's like, yeah, you have to get rid of her. Like, you have to break her heart, essentially, so that she's not, you know, stuck on you. So that night, it's a night of this ball, and we see Bruce Dern shutting her down, being like, no, I'm not going to run away with you.
I got a wife.
It's not going to happen. Then in classic fashion, we see the shadow of an axe being raised. Somebody murders Bruce Dern.
Chops off his head and hands.
And out in the middle, everyone is in their beautiful white gowns, dancing and waltzing along. And suddenly all eyes turn to the door. They all look. And out comes young Charlotte, her dress covered in blood. And her dad waltzes through the crowd.
You come with me now, Charlotte. And you're a good girl.
And she says, I don't want to, Daddy.
I don't want to.
I don't want to go. Cut to the future. Classic Grey Gardens-esque setting of this beautiful manor that is now unkempt. We have Charlotte played by Bette Davis.
Has never cut her hair since that day. She's got a beautiful long horse girl mane.
And she's up on the veranda, balcony of this incredible manor, shooting at local developers, being like, get off the property.
This is my daddy's house.
They want to knock down the house. And she's like, I'm not having it. And her cousin comes to visit. Her cousin, played by Olivia de Havilland, comes to visit and essentially is trying to persuade her to say, you have to leave the house. We have to get you out of here. And the film begins a story of, Charlotte is much further along in her decline than we thought. She's losing her mind. She's seeing visions nightmares and ghosts of her past. And essentially, this just feels like taking the character of Baby Jane, of someone that's trapped in the purity and innocence and success of their youth, and painting the empathy of that idea across the whole film instead of popping it just at the end like Baby Jane does, where you essentially are just watching someone be a mess, just be completely unreasonable, literally an adult child, until it starts to be revealed that there's more at play in terms of how their life declines. Did you see, I guess we were talking about the twist.
Of who did the axe and who actually did the killing.
Who was doing the axe as it
Charlotte
happened.
Has become a local legend for.
And it happens in the middle of the film so that it can sort of reveal that there are even more twists at hand than you think. What is the twist of Hush, Hush, Sweet Charlotte?
The twist, as in Baby Jane, it turns out the demure, nice, more seemingly healthy and wholesome relative is responsible for all the madness and craziness. So Bruce Dern's wife, who I guess found out about the infidelity way, way, way back when in the 20s, she was the one that chopped him up.
Mm-hmm.
And Olivia de Havilland, Charlotte's cousin, covered it up, knew about it, was a witness, and was blackmailing this old wife, played by Mary Astor. And now, to get all of Charlotte's daddy's money and to get the house, she has been driving Charlotte mad with a fake head in a box.
Elaborate staged sort of means to make her think that she's losing her mind.
To make her go nuts and send her to the nut farm.
This is the bigger beat where I would say of the hagsploitation trope, exploitation-wise, we are playing into the idea that you can just make a person crazy by doing little theatrical setups.
Well, they do also drug her, which is that's true. Chemically you are making it.
But some of the ones they do, bonkers. Like for example, Bette Davis in her book says, I did think it was a bit over the top to have the head literally falling
down the stairs.
Essentially, there's a bit where Olivia de Havilland is at the top of the stairs and she's like, what's wrong? And then her suitcase opens up and
Bruce Dern's head fumbles out of it.
And it's ultimately revealed this is literally a prop head. Mm. They are trying to drive her crazy. And I think this film's greatest strength, what literally had me the whole time, of the six we've watched, I don't think through our discussion my mind will change that this is my favorite of the six.
Really?
I just think it has so much more nuance to say about the characters it's painting, and you feel for them so much. And just the idea it's talking about is one that I love in stories in general, which is the way in which certain personality types we excuse them or we make assumptions about them.
Yeah. It's funny then that the villain, Olivia de Havilland, is in public relations because it's all about publicity. Mm. It's like, yeah, Baby Jane just had this bad, I mean, not Baby Jane, oh my goodness, Sweet Charlotte, I'm so sorry. She's had this bad publicity for decades and decades that she's crazy, she's overprotected, much like the Britney song says. She's unhinged. And meanwhile, the virtuous townsfolk have looked on and been like, oh, one crazy person, wow, what are we meant to do with her? Meanwhile, it's this well-put-together outsider, Olivia de Havilland, who's really well cast because she's in Gone with the Wind. She's Melanie, the lovely plantation girly. She is the one that is really like composed enough to make evil decisions and do evil. Poor Charlotte is just
exactly. It's that classic thing of like, because like what Bette Davis's whole life would be, which would be like, you know, you are depicted or seen as
difficult,
a hag, like as this difficult diva, whereas actually you're just like, you know, the way you always express it might not be acceptable or like kind, but it's true. Whereas like you are surrounded by these women who ostensibly are very kind and compassionate and actually are like deeply resentful or like really plotting, or yeah, like this film is these two characters where initially you view, you know, you are taught through the social idea of a hag to view Charlotte as someone to be dismissed and be like, you are like such a mess.
You're a witch.
And actually the film so masterfully just makes you feel, we're going to talk about this one sequence where our breath was taken away, but you just feel for her so deeply.
Yeah.
Whereas the flip of the cousin character
really being mustache twirlingly evil, like she has a big villain monologue like, I can't believe we're about to get away with it.
And it just makes you like not even feel like it's like an unearned flip. It makes you feel like I bought the mask you wear. Yeah. Like I bought, like everyone does, like I bought the bullshit that you peddle to the world, that you're just like, you know, this compassionate, nice person trying to do what's best, when actually you are the one who has gaslit and manipulated this woman's whole life. Like you've ruined her entire life for your own
scheming game. Witch and a hag.
Exactly. Let's talk about this one.
Yeah, the dream sequence. My goodness.
So beautiful.
Something like this in Baby Jane would have been awesome as well.
Oh, absolutely. Essentially, it's one of these scenes where she's being induced into like feeling
this
like she's crazy.
This reverie of the past.
And she makes, so she, like Baby Jane, has been like dressing up like her young self, you know, playing piano. And she waltzes through her house and the house suddenly, it's like it's transported back to the night of the ball.
It's silent except for wind chimes in the background.
Which is
that were a noticeable sound detail at the start of the
movie. We were so scared. Like we were like, this is so creepy but beautiful. Like you're happy for her, but like
all the extras are wearing masks that make them like faceless, just mannequins in the background.
So they're wearing these like tuxedos and things, but their faces,
they're frozen in time.
Yeah. And as you said, it's like silent. And just her performance, she's such an incredible actress. We spoke about it last week, but just, and we'll speak about it with Joan Crawford's film Straight Jacket next, but just what she allows herself to do feels so unheard of for this era of filmmaking, of like, she's so still, she commands such attention. Mm. You see her mind regress to childhood and it's that thing where you're scared for her because
she's so fragile.
She's so
and
fragile.
You know it's going to all shatter and that you know that it's a dream. Because
but you want her to be happy as well. Like she's seeing Bruce Dern, this young boy that like, again, she was groomed.
Again.
Like she was six, she was young.
Yeah.
And this was some man that was married being like, let's run away together. Like her whole life has been ruined by people using her as a pawn in their games.
Mm.
And she's waltzing with this vision of, her old boyfriend, and then is using, we know in real life it's a gun, but for her it's a bouquet. Mm. So she sees this bouquet as like, this gun as like a bouquet.
Mm.
And then
she offers it to him.
She offers it to
him. She kneels before, bows to him like you do before you dance. And then as her eyes run up his body, he's headless. And she shoots the bouquet at him, like bullets come out the end of it. It's so sick.
It's so good.
The way the glowy look of it, like they bumped up the contrast in this smeary, like dreamlike way. It's so beautiful.
And it like glistens. Yeah. I think in general also just like means we need to point out that like I didn't know before watching this it was Robert Aldrich. I'd already popped it on.
Yeah.
And it is nice to be reminded of like what great direction is, because that first 10 minutes you're like, why is this so good? What is it? And you're like, oh, it's really well directed. Like there is so much tension building in this. More so than I would say Baby Jane, where like there are long stretches of stillness or not much happening, but it feels like it's building to something. Like it feels like your attention is being directed really carefully.
Yeah. I think we should talk about the similarities and differences between the movies.
Yeah.
Because Baby Jane is much better known. It's set in LA, Hollywood. Like it's a much more callous place. There's a lot of like nasty side characters. It's more fun. It has more moments of like shrieking camp. This movie, I think the Southern setting adds a lot to it, that it like all of, as you said, like all the side characters are very genteel and they have that Southern like, oh, bless her heart, when they're actually saying something horrible thing. It has the Southern Gothic thing of like these rich shadows, and it's a more remote setting. It's swampy and rural, and it's a lot sadder and more sincere.
I was going to say, I think it's, you know, I think a large part of this is because Baby Jane created the trend, because it had the publicity.
It was more shocking and sensational.
Around it. Yeah, exactly. But I think it's very telling of the difficulty of hagsploitation as a subgenre that we're talking about, that says it always allows for pathos and sort of like schlock fun, but the more it does seem like the more nuance and like respect that you try to give to women going through, you know, the regrets
these
of life,
crazy situations,
these crazy situations, the less it appeals to the public. Like I just am like, this would be one I would recommend to literally everyone. My heart breaks for her in such careful, calculated beats, where usually, you know, as we talked about some of these films, the moments of like insightful dialogue are less the focus, and then more so it's just sort of like the structure of a horror film, you know. But there are inclusions here that I was ready to dismiss that revealed themselves as really beautiful. There's this one character that's like an older man, and he's like a reporter.
Yeah.
And essentially he's like, oh, this is one true crime case that just like,
it's really stuck with
me. It's always stuck with
me. I kind of believe in Charlotte.
And it just becomes this beautiful beat towards the end of, as we said, at the start of the movie, you're laughing at her, you're dismissing her. And now you see her as this victim of people manipulating her mind her whole life. And there's something about this man that really brings home that idea of like people of good spirit and humanity that look you in the eye and see the truth of your story. Like there's this idea that he knows.
He's like us. He's covering these women and extending sympathy to them.
And extending some sympathy to them, exactly. He's carrying the tradition. But really, like it's so beautiful. He kind of gets the final beat of the movie where she has discovered the ploy.
The plot
she's
against
finally
her,
released herself from the idea that she's like, you know, she says like, I didn't used to think I was losing my mind, but now I'm not so sure. And there's this idea of like, she's freed herself, but now.
And she's been a recluse and she finally leaves the house. It has a happy ending.
And you see her physicality change.
Baby Jane.
Exactly. Like you see her almost return to her body and herself. And there's this just like pride you have for her that
she's been vindicated and, you know, can take it from here.
And that old man sort of looks at her and there's just this like moment of two actually good people, like, who in terms of like how they've lived their life have maybe done bad things, but like in this moment they meet in old age.
Oh my God.
Vindicated.
So beautiful.
Yeah. And I'm just like, where fuck was, like, I didn't expect any of that from this movie. You
Are
know?
You alone in this? Like, do people ever say, like critics or historians, that Hush Hush Sweet Charlotte is actually superior to Baby Jane?
No, not really.
Maybe it's just, I think at the moment it's just that Charlotte is like novel to me because it was the first time watching it. I don't know if I like it more.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I'm like pretty like gagged by it or whatever. I think it's like an amazing movie. And at the moment I like it more than Baby Jane. But I kind of want to sit with it fresh. For a while. Yeah.
I think that whilst Baby Jane wasn't as black and white as I thought it might feel on a second viewing, like I do think it gives a lot of nuance to Baby Jane's character. I do think it views Joan Crawford in a pretty simple way and sort of dismisses that character. And I think this film sees the potential of two women who have dealt with the pressures of life and fame and money and expectation in different ways and puts the politics of that through the whole film so that your feelings about characters is constantly flipping. Also, we should say with that, it means that the role that was originally meant for Joan Crawford, that here is Olivia de Havilland's, just is so fun. Like the mustache twirling she gets is great.
She's very evil.
There's a really great moment where, again, it's sort of like a very twisty story. So to try and explain the logistics of that, I'm like, you know what? You should just watch it for yourself because it's a great movie. But to put it simply, it has now been revealed that Charlotte actually killed someone when she shot
In that dream sequence.
In that dream sequence with that bouquet gun. And now her cousin is helping her like
dump the body.
And in a Incredibles, again, if Baby Jane had some of this, it would just feel like such a better discussion of these different characters and how truly good or bad either of them are, where you see the cousin flip and Olivia de Havilland's performance is her looking at Charlotte and like every word she says, this one particular line is so biting. She's literally like, would you shut up for what? Like just that idea of being like wanting to stab someone with your words. And it illustrates the assumptions we've made about them both so perfectly, because the whole first half of the movie, Charlotte is the one screaming and ranting.
Yeah, I mean, she earlier says to the cousin, you vile, sorry little bitch.
Exactly. And we were cackling.
So they each get their turn.
And then by this point in the movie, now Charlotte is in the car sobbing like a little girl, being like, it's too hard, it's too hard. I'm sick of it, it's too hard. She's fully a child. And this other woman that the whole movie to us has been like, I'm just trying to do the right thing. Her first instinct is like, let's get the body in the car. You're going to get out and help me put it away. Come, get out of the car. She, at one moment, she slaps her.
Like there's a lot of slapping.
6 times in a row. And you're like, everything I knew about the assumptions we make about a hag style woman have been flipped. Like it's just got so much more nuance to it, I think.
I think it takes away from it a little that they're cousins rather than sisters. And they're estranged cousins. Like they haven't seen each other that much.
Does it? Because yeah. It gives an element of remove that says like, oh, you're just my cousin, so I wouldn't. Like that's such an intimate thing to do to someone that's closer to a friend than a sister.
They have this like complex past together. But I think, I don't know, I feel like there's less story reason for them to be so codependent than Baby Jane, where they're living in the same house for 30 years.
Yeah, yeah. That's true to it. Yeah. I do agree. I just think Joan Crawford gets really lost in Baby Jane and it's annoying. But this film, it just gives them both so much to do.
Yeah.
I just think they're both brilliant in it. Before we move on, I'm going to rant at you about a bit more Bette Davis juice.
Yay.
Because there's just too much to give, okay? You mentioned Gone with the Wind briefly. Mm-hmm. And I feel like I didn't give enough context into what My Mother's Keeper actually has like stories about. Mm. And I find it really funny that like, having only heard Bette Davis's reaction to her daughter's book, you feel like the stories you're going to hear are going to be like, you know, she says that I abused her in this way or tortured her in this way. The very first points that she brings up are
Betty
like...
Bette brings up.
Yeah, that Bette brings up are very petty Hollywood drama things, such as, you made the ridiculous assumption that I wasn't able to get the lead role in Gone with the Wind. I didn't accept the role in Gone with the Wind. Like, that's what anyone would most care about in a book where your child is being like, you emotionally abuse me.
Yeah.
Exactly. It very much had, you know, that meme of from like that reality show. I don't know what it is, but the girl's being like, "You said that I wore little red BB boots, and
like, you said I wore 3-inch Louis Vuitton heels when they were actually little brown BB shoes. Yeah. $39.
Now we have to record it again. Yeah, like, yeah.
Alexis Nyers.
Yeah, just very like petty. Yeah, petty
it's like
drama.
You're focusing on the wrong crime.
Exactly. Yeah. So all of these films are about. You know, a lot of them open with some sort of murder and yeah. It's like...
Who? Title card, back in ye old times, this happened. Where are they now?
Someone dies. They're killed by like a silhouette on the wall with an axe or something, right? Which actually is very relevant for Bette Davis. This isn't in her book at all. This is just, you got to do your research and find out that there is a lot of justifiable evidence that Bette Davis unintentionally killed her second husband.
Oh!
Bette Davis was married 4 times, divorced 3 times. Her second husband, one day he was walking down Hollywood Boulevard. He goes, collapses, convulses on the floor. Everyone's like, what's going on? He had a suitcase next to him. Suitcase in the shuffle gets lost. He's taken to hospital. He dies later in hospital. Initially, because he had military contacts, people thought there was something in the suitcase, but later, a young boy returned the suitcase and was like, I just stole it because I saw an opportunity to steal it. But it's believed that like that helped confuse the trial and the case and stuff because days before, I don't know if it's the day before or a few days before, Bette Davis had thrown a chair at his head and hit him in the head.
Oh my God.
And he died of like a brain aneurysm. So there is like huge evidence to support the fact that like unintentionally,
I mean,
she killed him.
She threw a chair at his head. It's like, that's pretty bad.
Yeah, exactly. And that thing where like he obviously had like had some sort of, brain
what did they think when it was the suitcase that it had like radiation or poison or something in it?
Or no, more so that like he was like assassinated for government secrets or something.
Okay, all right.
Isn't so that, that's like something out of any of these movies. That's something from one of these movies, right?
Did I just find that amazing. They did an autopsy?
I'm not sure. I think so. It just seems like the classic case of like a Hollywood death where you're like, cool. And then what else did they do? And you're like, there's no evidence of how that legal proceeding happened at all. So
my goodness.
I know. But yeah, in general, Bette Davis, one tough mama.
She, we're like girl bossifying that. We're and like, then, yeah, yes, like, mama.
Yeah, get it. No. Kill him. No, she again.
She chair like, his head. Oh my
that's
God.
That's horrible. That's the most Hollywood ass shit ever. But yeah, her whole story is ridiculous. She was regarded as one of her nicknames was the fifth Warner Brother because she like essentially was in all of
had
the highest
so
grossing films, was with them for years. She, and also I think we've talked a lot about like her being a real actress, not just like a glamour actress or anything. A huge part of that is being once silent films went out and they were transitioning to talkies, they were bringing a lot of stage actors over to help make the transition. And right from the start, the story of Bette Davis was kind of evidenced in this. She arrived on the train and was told someone from Warner Brothers is going to pick you up at the station. And she waited all day long. No one picked her up. And she called on the phone. She called the studio and was like, hi, did you forget to send someone to pick me up? And they were like, what are you talking about? No, we sent someone to go pick you up. They waited for ages and they said there was no one there that looked like an actress. So
that's so mean. Classic. She was beautiful.
She was absolutely always set up to be, she was beautiful, absolutely,
that's
but
so funny.
Always set up to be, you know, a future undesirable woman in these films. Yeah, that is just the story of this woman constantly being let down by men, being viewed
so
as
killing
not,
some of them with chairs.
Killing some of them with chairs. She also ranks. The reasons why most couples get divorced. And she says sex is number 4th. Underneath, at number 2, couples that only have one bathroom.
Huh.
That's the number 2 reason people get divorced, apparently.
Do you know what number 1 was? Probably like money or
jealousy
or something like that.
Yeah.
Anyway, goodness. Should we hush about Sweet Charlotte and move on to Joan Crawford?
We should. She's gotten enough of my time. Let's move on to the next lady.
Everything is going to be all right. You have only to stay inside. You only have to stay all right. Do not look outside. Do not need to look outside. Look out, look out, look out, look out, look out.
The opening minute, 40 seconds of Straitjacket are bloody hilarious and must be seen to be believed.
All time.
The first time we watched this movie, our jaws were on the floor at how this William Castle movie starts.
We rewinded it, filmed it, sent it to a lot of people I know, and it's now
saying,
on my Instagram.
Can you believe this? Yeah. What happens is there is a scream. Then there's a newspaper and you hear a newsboy say, "Extra, extra, read all about it. Love Slayer insane." It's like, all right, I'm aboard. Then you hear a news announcer say, "Lucy Harbin was declared legally insane today."
And then
ragtime music plays. It's like four.
It feels like receiving six slaps from Betty Davis. It's amazing. It's amazing.
It is wild. And it signals that we're moving on to, I think as you sort of introduced, I don't know if that was last episode for Patreon, we're moving into the exploitation part because this is directed by William Castle, B-movie maestro, gimmick king. The poster for this film, Straitjacket, has a warning on it, which is like a classic, you know, you're told, warned away from a shocking element of a film and it just makes you want to see it more. It says, "Warning, Straitjacket vividly depicts axe murders."
Get him, William
Castle.
Do you
think that's true? Do you think the movie vividly depicts axe murders?
I don't think that the head cleanly just pops off like you're like
no
popping off
Lego
like a
minifig.
Yeah, exactly. But I guess it is like you see axes come down, hit dummies, and then the heads roll off. Yes.
Yeah. I don't think it's that vivid. I think it's so funny that at some point in 1964, the year of our beautiful mum, Leanne, my favourite hag.
Our favourite hag of them all.
I will explain. I'll talk to her about it.
Yeah, sorry, mum. Sorry, mum. Sorry, mum.
Sorry, mother. The year that she was born, that this was a shocking, disgusting, reprehensible movie.
It's so even just as I commented on briefly with Hush, Hush, Sweet Charlotte, that Betty Davis was like, "Do we need the head rolling down the stairs? It felt like a stretch." And I'm
and
like,
it's like, yes, we need it.
We need it. And it's the most interesting part of these movies is these like weird, silly depictions of violence inside women's stories that you're like, no matter how silly you try to make this, she's actually acting this very well because she clearly feels it. Like,
can I just interject and point out that it makes me so mad how much discourse there is these days about like young progressive people and their trigger warnings when almost every other movie that you have mentioned having a film poster in the bus, like, I don't know, 10, 15 episodes of the podcast has had something like this on the poster warning from like the 60s. It's like, people have been doing this shit forever.
And you
don't
have
little kids
now
wandering in to see this stuff. You don't want people to like see this stuff before they're like ready to see it. It doesn't like undercut the value of the art, blah, blah, blah.
Exactly.
So
you're right.
I'm like, just check the poster. William Castle's probably screaming at you that that's what it is. Yeah.
Yeah. It should also be said, Straitjacket is written, the script is written by Robert Block, who wrote the script for Psycho.
Wow.
And
there you go.
This movie is a really funny reversion of Psycho.
It
sort
is.
Of. It's about a mum and daughter.
Mm-hmm.
Joan Crawford is the mum, Lucy Harbin, who has been away in an institution for 20 years for her crimes, cutting off her husband's head because she found him in bed with another broad. And she comes out of the nut house, reconnects with her daughter, but traces of the madness are still there. And much like in Hush, Hush, Sweet Charlotte, they are being constructed as part of a nefarious plot to drive poor Joan Crawford crazy.
That's right. You know that idea like with an alcoholic or like a drug addict or something of like, if you were like, "Oh, we should have a drink." Sorry, dude. We can all like, maybe we'll go to a movie or something. This film's equivalent of that is anytime someone's like,
"Hey, do you want to chop off a chicken's head with this axe?" And she's like, "Oh," and they're like, "Oh yes, I imagine that would be a little troubling for you." It's like,
they're like, "Oh yeah,
yeah."
Those pigs, they're going to be slaughtered later tonight. Oh, so like she's like, she gets triggered every time she sees sharp objects, essentially, because she's an axe murderer.
Yeah, she gets triggered when she sees the jangling bracelets that she wore while she did the murder. Her daughter encourages her to wear a wig and get a makeover so she looks exactly like she did on the night of the murders. It's barely gaslighting. It's really unsubtle. I don't know what you call gaslighting.
Did
but
we know
like,
it the first time? I think we knew it from the last like 30 minutes, but the first hour of the movie, you're like, this daughter's really bad at knowing how to help her mother adjust.
Yeah, like, she's very pushy, being like, Mom, keep it together. I'm trying to get together with a guy. I'm trying to get his parents' approval. You need to be so normal. Don't be crazy, Mom. And Joan Crawford is like,
You need to be hot. You need to be obsessed with how you look. You need to be a good homemaker. And then in one of the films, like the scenes that has the most, I guess, like outside of just like crazy old broad, who is it? The most like to say about where her mind might be is one of those scenes where, again, she's had this big makeover and she's sort of like, I don't feel depressed anymore. I feel like myself. Like, it essentially paints a pretty, like, I don't think a super exploitative. Like, I think it's a pretty respectful portrait of, like, a woman that used to exist to be desirable to men. And that's part of why she killed her husband, was being like, you know, I used to be, like, this, like, sex symbol for you and now I'm just, like, your wife. And essentially what happens to her when she, like, gets this makeover and is like, whoa, I don't feel depressed anymore. I feel like my old self is... The second she meets her daughter's soon-to-be fiancé, she is like a pick-me girl. She's like shoving her daughter out of the way.
She's like nightmare mother-in-law.
And not even subtly, like she's literally like putting her fingers in his mouth and stuff and being like, I didn't know you'd be this good, like this handsome. Ooh, like it's the scene that when you finish the film and you see what the big plot twist is, you're like,
no, that was still really weird of her.
That was still an interesting moment.
She wasn't being gaslit to act like that. She was being very strange.
That was her actually being like, in a really, it's actually the film of the six we've talked about that most is about being a quote unquote hag in relation specifically to male validation, I think.
Yeah.
Because it's her being like, if I am not the mask I wore when I existed to be a desirable,
a beautiful girl,
then I literally am nothing. Like, she doesn't know, like when she arrives, she's like a shell of herself. She's disheveled. She doesn't know how to exist because she's been away for so long. And the only version of herself she knew was a younger version of herself that was a wife.
There's a really telling bit of narration about all this where, so you've had that fucking insane opening that we described. And then there is a like flashbacky past scene of the murders. But before that, it's Joan Crawford looking gorgeous, de-aged, like she's meant to be like in her 20s or whatever. And the narration says Lucy is very much a woman and very much aware of the fact.
Yeah.
So we're coming back to awareness where it's like almost because she's went nuts and did crime, she is not even a woman anymore. Yeah. Like she doesn't know what she is. And then putting on makeup and a black wig makes her a woman again and makes her know who she is. And the movie's sinister horror-y elements, bodies cropping up everywhere, her daughter helping her hide the body and hide the car, which is very psycho, is stripping her of her femininity and identity. And those two things being inextricably linked.
Absolutely.
And like she's nothing if she's not a beautiful woman.
Exactly. She's nothing if she doesn't exist for men. And it's why I think, as you said, Hush, Hush, Sweet Charlotte would have been a great twin pick for Baby Jane. But it's also really suited to this film as well because they both have the element that we'll speak to in a sec, which is the plot twist being the figure that was ostensibly a pristine, ideal woman.
An ally to her and a carer.
Was the one that's manipulating you. And has a final beat that actually lives less in a schlocky place and more... This one does, just like Psycho, have the really bad like... Here's a final explanation of
you what, see, this is how they got away with it. Look and you're closer like, at this knife, blah, blah, blah. Yeah. And you're like, I get it. I got it.
I'm not fucking dumb.
It's all right.
But it does give you the chance to watch the character and you're like, oh, you've actually, through discovering this plot to break your mind, now you're free. Like you've found the ground again. And there's this idea of hope because you get to live as whatever the new version of you going forward is going to be.
Yeah, like Betty Davis in Charlotte.
Like Betty Davis in Charlotte. That idea of like at the end, you know, the whole movie, we've maybe laughed at you, then we felt bad for laughing at you. And now we have hope for you because you, for the first time, have the opportunity to live.
Your return to yourself.
And to discover what a woman looks like at this part of her life that is independent, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, let's talk about the twist.
Oh my God. I think the twist is so well executed.
It's so scary.
It's scary.
The way uncanny she looks effect is so creepy.
So yeah, it's her freaking daughter. Her daughter has been, she also was driven mad by seeing her dad and his mistress chopped up in front of her. So Joan Crawford did go axe crazy.
Yeah. At the start of the movie, she did kill her husband.
Unlike Sweet Charlotte. Mm. And all these years later, the daughter is resentful and kind of jealous of her mom's life in a way. Sort of like, you stole my whole future from me by going crazy.
I don't think it's that intentional, but it is the like epiphany thing that has been inherited of being like, specifically the plan is if I frame you for these murders, then I... she's trying to get her mother to kill her soon-to-be fiancé's parents so that she can be with her fiancé. Mm. But also what is layered through it is just a like personal vendetta revenge thing that says, my mother is a crazy hag.
Yeah.
She's a crazy evil like vixen, like bitch, essentially, which is what she has been sold her whole life.
Yeah.
By the stories of her mother, the nursery. Every one of these films has a creepy nursery rhyme about the hag. Like,
yeah,
all
what is
of
it?
Them
Lucy
do.
Lucy Harbin took an axe and gave her husband 40 whacks. When she saw what she had done, she gave his girlfriend 41.
Oh my God, how'd you remember that?
Because it's Lizzie Borden took an axe. They just reskinned it.
All right. That's catchy. Good for you.
Thank you very much.
But yeah, but there is a vendetta to it that's really sad.
Mm, the reveal rocks so much. So in the home of her fiance's parents, who she hopes to be her in-laws, whatever, the parents are getting picked off. Someone raises an axe. Someone that looks an awful lot like Joan Crawford, has the black bobbed hair with bangs, has a beautiful day dress on, raises an axe, and we start to see there is something off about this person. From behind, it looks like Lucy. It looks like Joan Crawford. But then Castle gives us a few angles of her face and it looks fucked. It looks really strange and mask-like.
It's like the current equivalent of like AI Uncanny Valley thing.
Yeah.
It's so effective. Because
but it's just through editing. It's just
so
that you
good.
Don't get to look at it properly.
Yeah.
And then just as you're starting to be like, oh, is that a mask? Who is that? Joan Crawford comes in. And so you're like, oh my God, it is not her. It's someone else, obviously. Duh.
Mm.
And Joan Crawford wrestles with the mask version of herself, which is so cool. And when she finally rips it off, it's her daughter who's crazed and is like, you ruined my life, blah, blah, blah.
And like, we can be together now to her husband and her boyfriend and stuff.
Why do you have your mom's wig on? What is going on? And is really unsettled. It's so well done. The pacing of it is like how you would do it today.
It is. And as you said, like the way filmmaking wise, it's like shown to you is you genuinely are always ready to put your finger on what it is, but you haven't quite got enough visual information yet.
Mm.
Like it is uncanny. It really is like, oh, wait, no. Wait, is it? Like you're really uncomfortable. It's
the timing
really
is perfect.
Disconcerting. Because it's not so much of a mask that it doesn't look like her.
Mm.
I think at first I thought it was just thick makeup.
Yeah.
And then she's putting her fingers underneath the mask and you're like it's literally right. like a latex mask.
Because they established that the daughter is a sculptor and an artist. So she can also sculpt incredibly lifelike heads to torture her mom, in Sweet Charlotte. There's a lot of fake heads being made to drive Betty Davis and Joan Crawford.
It really is in terms of like sometimes we're doing genres that, you know, like if we did Giallo, that would be one where like every film takes some things and not others. And sometimes it's hard to really label like what is one and what isn't one. Of the four films we've talked about so far, particularly three of them all have like at least five plot beats I haven't seen in any other films this year and they are all in the one
film. Kindly maid who's like, are you sure Miss Whatever's okay? I'm going to go check on her and
that
dies.
Is made to look crazy and dies. Yeah. Absolutely. This one I would say really, this is like maybe the most accessible of them all because it's also just like fun and simple.
Mm. And Joan Crawford, she sells it. She really invests in the character. She does not phone it in at all. She's taking it very seriously. There's a bit where she's kind of like under the magnifying glass of these in-laws and they're being really rude to her. They're being like, you're crazy. Like, where have you been? How are we meant to accept your daughter marrying our son? And she is like, she's so tense, like her body language, and she screams at them. They're like, you were in jail. And she's like, it wasn't jail. It was an asylum. It was hell. 20 years of hell.
Yeah.
And like, she sells it so much.
I think doing the research for these episodes and really learning about that idea of Joan Crawford's height as like the most beautiful actress and Betty Davis's height as like the most talented actress made it interesting to rewatch Straightjacket and be like, you know, I don't think it was ever implied she was just beautiful.
Just a pretty face.
She was just a pretty face. But especially for what we've talked about with the Baby Jane idea that Joan Crawford didn't go there. Wasn't as quick to leap towards appearing as ugly or as not beautiful or not put together.
Not composed.
Which is like her values in life, in her personal life. This is a film where like she gets to experience both of those ideas. Again, this very silly plot and film in one way actually allows an actor to convey a real truth for them, which is this idea that assuming the role of the ideal woman is actually sort of like a protective.
Corrosive. Oh, okay. Other way.
Well, like protective to the how one sees themselves in that it gives you purpose, but like corrosive to her soul, absolutely. Mm. And then when it breaks down and she's exposed, it is this thing that appears hysterical, this thing that appears like it's what makes people disregard like a older woman in her anger in being like all I am to people are comfortable now just viewing me as a crazy person to be dismissed, but like I'm trying to learn how to live again and I'm being gaslit by my crazy daughter.
Yeah.
It's so fun. To deal with. It's really, really fun.
It is a really fun movie.
Yeah. It's crazy. All these films that are like both ridiculous and really beautiful.
Yeah.
I think this one does it best where, it's her performance and the writing of that character that you're like, I really feel for her.
You don't come out of it feeling humiliated for her as the character wants you to feel. You end up being like, damn, she did a good job.
We're over halfway now. How do you feel about it as a genre in terms of, as a subgenre in terms of whether we are making fun of or platforming a hag, an older woman with a whole lot of problems that usually gets dismissed?
I think there is a difference between how the movies are marketed and the stories they actually tell. Like we said for the poster for this one where it's like, Joan Crawford is crazy. Like, see it now. Like, warning, da-da-da, whatever.
Yes.
But then when we've talked about them, we have been really heartfelt in how we feel about their characters.
I think some of them, the pathos is written in more than others, whereas naturally the nature of using these like esteemed women with like incredible careers is that like they lend humanity to it. Naturally, I don't think it's not in the films, but like, I think everything we ever talk about with horror, particularly like popular American horror, is like splashy, sort of like tantalizing exteriors being packaged with like very sort of like sincere internal, like emotional experiences. And I think these are big films for that, where like, you can just watch and laugh, but I think you're actually missing out on what like the whole spectrum of the film sort of allows you.
I think a movie that will put this whole marathon into an interesting contrast is The Substance, which you haven't seen yet, right?
I'm seeing it tonight.
Oh my gosh, cool. Okay. The Substance has had some ageist debate around it of it is arguably hag-sploitation. I think it's more body horror and splatter, but it has a Demi Moore performance in it that sincerely wants you to feel her pain and empathize with her and wish the best for her. And then it, I believe, abandons that at some point and becomes something else.
Yeah.
But there has been debate around this of like, can you make a movie that's about ageism without exploiting it yourself? Like saying, well, the movie still wants us to see the young characters as hot and desirable and good and an ugly crone character as bad and repulsive.
Like to comment on a socially agreed upon like idea, even if it's unfounded, you do need to paint it as what it is. And like, does that endorse it or like it's not like, necessarily?
Yeah, I guess it's the sploitation thing that's troubling, right? It's like anything. It's like blaxploitation where it's like it rocks that for a period there was a window where there were awesome, colorful, vibrant, successful movies about black characters, but they're known by a white mainstream audience as being about pimps and drug dealers and crime and violence and sex and stuff. Like, it's just a tightrope you're always walking on. And at the moment, I'm on the I love hexploitation side of it.
Me too. But I think how often does the pendulum swing without packaging it in something that people will buy, without realizing like the whole thing that they might be getting as part of that meal, you know? Mm. I think it's sometimes just a good, it's why we love horror. It's like it exists on the ends of the spectrum where you kind of get to bring people in and maybe unintentionally make them think about that stuff in a way that usually they wouldn't. Like if that idea is too sobering, I don't think you get kids showing up to like laugh at it, you know?
Yeah, I think I would rather watch these than Betty Davis or Joan Crawford in like a Best Exotic Marigold Hotel where it's,
Hell, yes.
We're old, but we're still happy. Like, exactly. I'm like, no, kill each other.
Exactly. Well, we're over halfway. Next week's part three.
Oh my God, we're going into full on disgusting exploitation with the final chapter.
We are going turbo exploitation. These ones are much schlockier, much more graphic. They are both incredible, kind of hilarious films that we're really excited to talk about. The first is Butcher, Baker, Nightmare Maker.
Awesome title.
And the second is The Baby.
Man, and you have to be on Patreon to hear about That's it. That's it.
So if you didn't check out last week's We Loved It, check out part one and you can check out part three next week. That's on the Patreon. For your $5 a month, what could you... So to be one of us over on our Patreon, it's $5 a month. Eliza, what did you get for $5 this month?
Definitely heaps of coffees.
Yeah, is that one coffee or is that one and a bit of a coffee?
Coffee's like $6 now at some places.
Yeah, so exactly. There you go.
So make your coffee at home and subscribe to our Patreon.
Equally, if you're like, oh, I just want to test the waters a bit still, this is your reminder that now you can vote for our next cinematic punishment over on the slot bucket. That is available to all members of the podcast. So you can head over to our Patreon and just have a peruse. You can vote. And then, yeah, if you want to become a member, we would love to have you. Other than that, you can follow us on Instagram, Letterboxd, Facebook, and we'll see you for our last part of this Midnight Marathon.
Stay haggy.
Stay haggy. Love you very much. And swaggy.
Yeah.